Well, thank you so much, everybody, for coming along to one of the events in the first ever Bristol Festival of Literature. And we're really proud. It's all been put together with sheer volunteer sweat and power. So a little bit of the chaos and so on that's come into it is just, I'm afraid, part and parcel of it. Certainly, we'll be a hell of a lot more slick next year, okay? But maybe not. Maybe we just like it this way. Okay? Without any further ado, I'll just quickly introduce our guests tonight. We have Roger Ball and Steve Mills from the Bristol Radical History Group, and Canon Tim Higgins from St. Stephen's Church in town, and the session will be led by Marvin Rees. So please, can you give a very big Bristol hand motion in that order, increasing in speed and volume.
All right, thank you. I'm glad you mentioned the chaos, because that takes some of the pressure off. So you know, hopefully, roughly why you're here. Well, not roughly, exactly, hopefully. 400th anniversary of the King James Bible, making it available to anyone who speaks English. And the legacy is with us. Either way, whatever you think of it, the legacy is with us today. So this evening's discussion is really around, you know, how radical has this event been? What is the legacy for us today? With this key question that's obviously caught in the title, is this the most dangerous book in the world? And we'll go through it with our guests today through a number of questions, just talking to them beforehand, some of the issues that they say may come up in the discussion, and some of that will be up to them. Much of it will be up to you, and what you will say and what you ask is gauging the impact of this book on British society and culture, distinguishing between personal and institutional responses to the book, and how different people in different times have used the book in different ways. So then maybe that will just get some of your thoughts going about how you might like to be thinking about the questions you're going to put forward this evening. You've had the introductions, obviously Steve in the middle, Roger and Tim on the end. The way we're going to run this is we're going to offer each panelist just 3 minutes to start. They may not take 3 minutes, but they've got 3 minutes. And then, once each person's done their 3 minutes, we're going to give them each a chance to come back at each other with one question and respond, and then we'll throw it open to you and we'll have a discussion. All I'd ask for you in the discussion bit is you know, make points, but let's keep them tight as well. You remember, the moderator, I've done, you do some moderating and sometimes people treat you like you're the oppressor, you know, the enemy suppressing free speech. But I'll throw it back to you. Remember, there's lots of people in the room, and more of you is less of someone else that's looking at you and want to say something. So we're just trying to create space for everyone. Okay? So again, to use Yari's words, without further ado, we'll move in. And I'm going to ask Roger to start off. And Yari, you're going to keep time, and you're going to politely...
Am I?
Yeah, you're going to politely give 30 seconds.
What do I do? A ding, ding.
Yeah, 30. When there are 30 seconds to go, give a ding, ding. And we all know what's going to happen. It's not green. Roger.
Right, King James Bible. I didn't know much about it until a few weeks ago, but I've been looking it up. So that's what you do when you're a historian. You go out and find out what it's about. I think most people know about King James Bible recently because of a book by Melvin Bragg, who, was obviously a Radio 4 presenter and all that. But what's interesting about it is I regard Melvin Bragg as being like a tool of this British establishment completely. And he's an apologist for British history. And it's a British history which kind of contains all these ideas about progressiveness, like the idea that, we brought democracy to the world, we brought democracy to the colonies. I'm lying, but that's what we're meant to think, and that's how I was brought up to understand the history. And similarly, the King James Bible fits into that as part of that history. It's part of like the movement forward away from like the idea of the Bible in Latin, and it became into English, and it became more democratic. It was part of the rise of Protestantism and modern British society. When you actually look into what the King James Bible is, you find that it's a little bit more complicated than that. There were actually 15 versions of the Bible in English before the King James Bible, so the King James Bible would start writing it in 1603. For a long period of time, the church in Britain had oppressed those people who tried to get the Bible into English. In fact, the famous one, Tyndale, you may have heard of, was actually burned in 1536 for producing a Bible in English. And actually, the King James Bible is not this new thing that the king decided to get his scholars to write. They just took a Bible that had already been written by a heretic who they'd burned, right, and used it, and they just changed all the words they didn't like and structured it in a way that would fit their model of a hierarchical, monarchical society. That's what it's about, and that's the big myth about the King James Bible, somehow it's progressive. And just to give you one idea about why this is important, what there's one word that's changed the most in the King James Bible, right? Changed from the earlier version to the Geneva Bible and Tyndall's. And that word is Ecclesiastes. And it means kind of, well, earlier versions would have said the people, the congregation. And King James came along with his scholars and said, we're not having that. We change that word to mean the church. So in the King James Bible, the church becomes central, the institution. Christianity is taken out of the control of ordinary people who can be non-conformists, do what they want, interpret it in different ways. It's controlled. The King James Bible was there to smother the market, to deal with a real situation which threatened them, which is an explosion of non-conformism in Europe and in Britain around the turn of in the 16th century.
Like 15 seconds.
So that's the point. It's a reactionary book because it's trying to smother lots of other ideas about Christianity, and it's trying to hierarchize the church and get it back in order and put these non-conformists back in the box.
Absolutely brilliant.
Through
to the next round.
Okay. Now I'm going to go to yourself, Tim.
Okay, thank you. I'm looking for the stocks. I haven't seen them yet, but I guess they're stocks tucked away. They're in here somewhere. I'm really glad to be here because I'm fascinated by the Radical History Group, which I've heard of before, and it's great to be here tonight. And a huge thanks for the introduction, because actually I was taken by the title. I mean, we all know it's the 400th anniversary thing, so that's a really important hook for tonight. But the title that first came my way was The Bible, the Most Dangerous Book. And I think it is. And I think it is because it is so subversive. If you think of the burnings of not only books but also people, if you think of the times it's been banned and made illegal, if you think of the ways in which states have shuddered at the use of the Bible. And just to bring it really local here in Bristol, and I'm not stealing your thunder, but I mean, I think one of the Bristol stories that has been important since I've been here anyway, for me, is particularly around a guy called Thomas Clarkson. And he was someone who actually, because of how he read the Bible, became a researcher into the raw and rough deal that sailors got. And that led him onto the whole issue of slavery, and he was a big research weapon, really, for the whole issue of equality and the abolition of slavery.
Bong, bong, big church bell for you.
Okay, so I think it is the most dangerous book because of two things. It's sometimes being used as a political weapon, but much more dangerous, it undermines oppression.
Thank you. That's time up.
Thanks. Me?
Yeah.
Let's keep the order.
Yes. I'm just joking.
I'm excited.
Okay. Steve, 3 minutes.
Thank you. I'll start now. Basically, I think the King James Book is a very dangerous book. I mean, as we just heard, it was written in 1611. It was basically, my understanding was to underpin James I of England. James Stuart had seen his mother butchered, his mother's lovers butchered in front of him. She was executed. There was religious turmoil on the continent. The Lutheran troops stabled in the Vatican City. Calvinists, Protestants and Catholics were lopping holes out of each other with gay abandon. And he was King of England. And it was a very dodgy situation. There was a high church, the Puritans, who later bothered and actually cut his dad's head off. And he needed to write something that underpinned, as he saw it, his divine right. And he set about getting some scholars from Cambridge and Oxford who underwrit this. And then my belief is it's been misused. I mean, it's been used in his father's trial by both sides to justify him getting his head cut off and not getting his head cut off. It's been used in the American Civil War to justify both sides. It's been justified by, it was used by the people who arrived in America, the chosen few as they saw themselves, to commit genocide in the indigenous population there. It's been used to subjugate women. It's been used against homosexuality. It's been misused in so many different ways. I think at the end of the day, it's a collection of stories that was written a long, long, long time ago.
It's
been misinterpreted and such like, and we need to move on from these old books and start regaining a trust and love of each other and the human race and stop killing each other. Because this Bible has led to so many murder and
rubbish.
Destruction.
Absolute
and rape.
Nonsense.
It is not
rubbish. You're not allowed to interrupt him.
I'm going to give him another
Let's get the clergy back in line.
Thank you very much. Well, just in answer to that, I mean, was it used by the Mayflowerians or not? And the answer is it was. It was used in the New Lands. They felt they were a
Time
chosen
up.
Few.
Thank you.
And that was racial persecution. No place for it. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you for that first round. Now, as promised, you get to come back at each other with a question. I'm going to say keep your questions tight. Keep your responses quite tight. We'll expand when we get into the audience shortly. I'm going to start with you, Roger. You have the chance to ask a question.
Well, I'll ask Tim.
Or Steve or Tim.
Probably Steve. No, my question is this really is like, you know, this question of church or people is very important. And what I'm trying to say is that contradiction's in the King James Bible, and I wonder what you thought about the fact that the people should have control of what they think, that the people should not have it mediated by institutions, and the people should come to understandings. I mean, do you agree with that or not?
I think part of the question will be, which people do you mean? And I mean, there is no doubt that the King James version of the Bible was a political tool. There's not much arguing about that. And you know, you've given a couple of illustrations to make the point. And there are lots of others. I mean, a lot of people have believed, and they still put this around, that the King James version was a translation of the Bible for the people. But actually, it was a posh version. And that's attested by the fact that people still campaign for it. You know, somebody actually did say, I'm told, that the King James version of the Bible is better English than the original. Well, you know, of course it wasn't written in English, was it? And so there's no doubt that if you want to illustrate that, you can do what Roger was saying. You can choose particular words, certainly. The word ecclesia can be translated as assembly, the gathering of the people, but that was actually also a very loaded word, as the word church was equally loaded. Ecclesia was loaded when it became congregation, because it was then the idea that a particular group of people with a particular set of convictions had the authority. So, you know, swapping that for the word church, the institution that the king was able to make appointments in, to deploy, and actually to fund. So the words in one of the most famous bits of the Bible, 1 Corinthians 13, you know, it ends with the greatest of these are the three, and somebody's going to help me with what they are. Faith, hope, and charity. And, you know, a previous word was caritas, or if you want it in Greek, agape, which is love. But it's actually unconditional love. Charity was a loaded word at that time, because it was exactly what the king needed to get funds into his church. So, absolutely right, it was a very political document, and it spoke to a particular group. People did not grasp it, the idea that it was a sudden publication and a raging success. It was anodyne in its reception. People did not rush to the bookstores and buy it. It became a political tool more effectively, perhaps later on, but initially it didn't actually strike quite that chord.
Okay, Tim, or could you Tom it? Tim, I'm going to give you a chance to come back with a question.
Okay.
And either Steve
completely
or
completely lost the plot now. I think my question would be around this notion that the Bible. Yes, I'm sure it's been used and will continue to be used and is now used by particular causes. You know, if you are campaigning for a particular oppressive view, yes, you will go and look for anything that moves people to your side. But actually, the issue is mostly in the 20th century, certainly it seems to me, about ideologies. And if I think of the Third Reich, they were terrified of the Bible. If you think of many of the big issues, and my question is it actually using the Bible as a source originally to get these views off the ground, or is it the other way around?
Steve? Where I got a lot of my information for my intro was also from the Melbourne... Can you hear me right? Was from the Melvin Bragg book. And I thought it was very interesting the way he used the Bible. When you say about the Third Reich, I mean, for the indigenous Indians, and I keep on going back to them, in the New World, as it was called then, which we now know as the United States, they must have been just as terrified, if not more terrified, of what was landing on their coast. And this Bible was used as justification for racial superiority, as I said. They felt that they were the chosen few, and they could utilise the words in the Bible to subjugate a whole race of people. This continued the course with slavery. I mean, I thought somebody here might bring up that the King James Bible was very influential in the abolition of slavery due to Wilberforce. I mean, admittedly, he did read it, but it's also at the time it was one of the few books that would have been in any person's house. It'd be unbelievable if he hadn't have read it. You know, we're all about the slaves and their use of gospels and such likes. But at the end of the day, the King James Bible was still utilised, once again, by the slavers for justification of their state, the capitalism that underpins the slave trade, and basically the murder of hundreds of thousands of people. And I could go on and on and on. And that's what I find disturbing about it. I mean, what I found extremely disturbing was Bragg was still going on about the Psalms being used as justification for the Iraq War. His own words, I've got it written down here, page 30-odd, I think. You know, in the book, he's got a picture of an American soldier with, a face mask over here with the Psalms written on it. Not too dissimilar to the Crusaders. I can dig it out of my bag now if anybody disbelieves me, you know. This is wrong. It's got to stop. We've got to stop murdering each other. There's got to be a better way of getting on with each other. Most Christians are perfectly okay, but you've got to leave this old tracks behind, forget it. You know, blessed that I come back. Eventually, certainly.
I will give you a chance to come back because you've got two questions against you. So, against.
Oh, yes, it is.
Two.
Come on, let's be clear.
I want to do those. Let me give Steve a chance to ask a question to keep the flow going. And then you'll come back. Have you got a question?
Okay, I do. I'm sat here in 2011. I must admit, when I was asked to come to speak here, we nearly had a fight, didn't know about who was going to come. We both wanted to come so much. Can you really tell me, in 2011, after the Enlightenment, the Renaissance, the rise in scientific knowledge, the medical knowledge we have, some of your own people, like Erasmus, if you like, but also Darwin and such likes, that is still relevant to this day to talk about. I mean, let's face it, the mistranslation that's gone on. Some Greek in 4 AD mistranslated young women into a virgin. And look at all the trouble it's made for our sisters now.
Yeah.
Horrible, awful thing. Why are we still discussing this book? Which is basically, I mean, you know, it's like a set of fairy tales that are written to give people some sort of guidance, take a bit out and take a bit in, you know. And really, it's about time we started moving on. I'm sorry, that's a rant. Why are we still discussing this book?
Take the opportunity to use this one and come back.
Okay. I think the quick response to that would be, how many of the wars, how many of the economic bits of oppression, and we mentioned the slave trade, I don't think that the slave trade was an idea let's start a slave trade because we've been reading the Bible. There is no doubt that anyone who is wanting to set up an economic system that is going to exploit will use any means possible. And the means that can be used through any religious expression are powerful because they try to get to people's passions, and they are manipulative potentially. But I think the real question is, if you think about the number of people that have actually lost their lives to change a state system, lost their lives to get the vote for women falling under horses, lost their lives because they have actually believed that the freedom which is given by equality of all people is actually there as a witness in the Bible. I'm not thinking of the King James Version, I'm thinking of the translations. The reason why it has been a threat and continues to be a threat in China and in a number of parts of the world is because it undermines power. The systems of understanding how we make peace rather than war are there in the teaching of nonviolent resistance, in the teaching of how reconciliation actually is achieved. And those are some of the things that I would actually want to see us talk about, rather than, you know, everybody agrees that if you're an exploitative person, then you will go for everything to manipulate other people.
Okay, so that's a lot of thinking to set the tone here. There's lots of issues and questions thrown up in the air. This reminds me, we're not going to resolve this one tonight. So let's just settle ourselves with that idea right now. So now I'm going to start throwing it open to you. You can come back to specific people, you can make a point, but remember, please keep it concise. We've got a lot of people here. We'll get a range of thoughts. Who'd like to go first?
Remember to speak up a little bit as well.
Thought or question. Wait for the microphone to point to you as well. Just over here.
I'm Cara. I'm just interested to know, like, you've all been talking about sort of the words that are in the Bible. Do you think it actually matters what the book is? Or is it about its place in our society? Like, if it was Grimm's fairy tales in the same place that had been used in religion and in the state, would it be just as bad or just as good, depending on how you see it?
Roger. Yeah, I mean, I think it is really important for a very simple reason. I mean, we're talking about mistranslation. I believe somebody once said the meek shall inherit the earth. Now, if I did the word now on, right, to that, which is what a lot of heretics were doing for several hundred years prior to the King James Bible, the meek shall inherit the earth now, right, is a very, very political statement, isn't it? Now, I can't imagine that most versions of the Bible would allow now to go in there, but that's actually the situation that people really lived in. That's their real material circumstances at that time. You know, they were peasants, they were oppressed, they did not have the right to read or write, they didn't have the ability to do it at the time, a lot of people. Also, they had, you know, the Bible itself was in Latin. Now, why is it in Latin? You know, why did people keep it in Latin for so long? It's because the mediators have control over the text. Unfortunately, because of all these peasant revolts and heresies, and people starting going, I'm going to write it into my local language and have a look at what this is all about, because that way we can level the church and remove all the mediators, because we can read it and interpret it. Hence you get the Quakers and all the other nonconformist sects, which were called a swarm of locusts that issued from a pit of hell by one commentator, because the whole time was about breaking out of these single ideologies, right, single controlled ideologies. First the Catholic, then Lutheranism, and then it fractures. Like, and it's fracturing because people are going, yeah, we can be critical. We can interpret the Bible from our position without people sitting between us telling us what's in the Bible. And that's really important.
Is it the relationship between the institutional church and the Bible that is problematic for you, or the Bible in and of itself?
You're absolutely right. It's the actual physical relationships in there, but also the way the text is put forward and interpreted by the mediators. So, you know, you can read the Bible, and as we all know, there's millions of stories in there, many of them contradict each other. You pick out the stuff you want, you change the words of the things you don't like. So, for example, the King James Bible, as you know, they removed the word tyrant, which was in there prior. 400 times as the word tyrant is mentioned. Now, of course, the king doesn't really want that word. You know, it's a bit problematic if it says kill the tyrant if he tries to, you know, usurp your power. You know, so, you know, the point is, it is important how it's written and it is important how it's interpreted. And all I'm saying is that it was actually the heretical movements and those new ideas of nonconformism that created the King James Bible, because they had to get it out and smother the market with their version,
Tim,
and their mediators.
Yeah, I mean, that's entirely right. This guy's done his homework, and it's very helpful. The word tyrant was taken out because it was linked to king.
Yeah.
And if you happen to be King James, then that's the very last thing that you could possibly expect, because King James believed that the divine right of kings was absolutely the case. So you couldn't have a tyrant. And so there's no question that these changes were made. But I think what we're picking up is this sense that we're actually seeing an example of how institutions do grab hold of opportunities to support their own interests and, you know, secure their own use of power. There's no doubt about that. And it's no surprise, of course, because if we do take seriously this notion that most human beings want to know why we're around, what's the purpose of my existence? Why am I here? How do I live with my sisters and brothers? These are the questions people need answers to.
Start by reading Darwin.
Yeah, then what do you find in the Bible?
Darwin, just come back. Did you have a thought on that yourself?
In answer to my own question?
Did you have it? You don't have to.
No, I don't think it matters which book it was. Like, if it was Grimm's Fairy Tales, it's been translated in hundreds of different ways. You can use those stories however you like. I think it's about where it fits in our society.
Imagine you move some of the stories. Yes,
thank you. We have to remember at the time we talk about the actual writing of the King James Book, the state and the church were intrinsically entwined. They were part of each other, you know. So basically, when that Bible was written, it went out to every church in the country, and that's what was rammed down our children's throat. If we didn't go to church, we might suffer sanction. There was still the tithe system, which took 10% of our earnings. I could go on and on. And as I said, you know, they were chopping lumps out of each other on the continent for it. And most Protestant princes didn't give a monkeys about religion at the time. They wanted to become Protestants. They didn't have to give their money to Rome. And it was basically that. So they utilised a Bible, which was the book of statecraft. It was as important as Machiavellian and the Prince at the time, you know, for that sort of state building. No doubt about it. And it's still been abused today, as I say, about the troops in Iraq. We need to cut it out of our system.
So earlier, one of the gentlemen...
Did you say who you are? Do you mind?
I'm John Moulton, actually Yari's dad, by the way. So, I'm honoured to be here. No, it's not cheating. I'm not being primed at all. And I'm not even a Bristolian. I did, online. One of the few. Earlier somebody said, we live in the 21st century, you know, we've got all this modern science and whatever and whatever. And I thought the title... But since then, the discussion's gone back to all the history. You know, we can all read now. We all get a reasonable education. Even the Chinese now can read English. Probably more of them read English than some of our kids that leave school here. But we have the books everywhere in multiple translations. We can think for ourselves and choose for ourselves. So why are we still going on about all the mistakes made in the past? Because the title for tonight was, is the Bible God's most dangerous book? Not was it. So that's my question to you. Is it, not was it?
Where does it fit in today's context? Then?
Well, I think it's important, first of all, because what we're touching on is the difference between ideology and theory, right? So I would say theory is where you have ideas, and ideology is where ideas have you, right? And the problem with the Bible is, even now, right, is that it's an ideological doctrinal document. It's the text, right? Now, I don't believe in any society, you know, whether, you know, any society should be based on the writings of one book. You know, and that's what it is. You can, all this other stuff, it is the book, isn't it? I mean, you're not going to, if somebody rolls up and says, oh, I've written this, like, you know, and I think we should follow this set of doctrines, you're not going to, all the Christians of the world are not going to drop it. I go, oh yeah, that's much better. But in fact, they did a lot in Latin America in the 1960s and 70s. They were dropping the Bible a lot, the peasants in Latin America, which is why the Catholic Church had to react and create liberation theology, because they were worried about all these people dropping the Bible and thinking, this does not produce social justice. What we need to do to produce social justice, right, is that we need to organise, and they join Marxist guerrilla groups, for example.
But that's
problematic. It's the question. We're going to just about ideology and about theory.
We're going to come up to you in just a second. But that's quite a statement, isn't it, about motivation? Because you could read liberation theologians like James Cone, who would totally refute what you said, that what they're doing is trying to make Christianity appealing in a revolutionary context. To say, actually, no, this is what I read here, and this is the outworking of my faith.
I agree. I mean, I'm being harsh, and I've met quite a lot of liberation theologists. I mean, to give you an idea of why I changed my mind a little bit about them, because I think the conference was set up in 1968 to do that. But the point is, what liberation theologist I met once, I said to her, like, you know, so all right, you're a Catholic liberation theologist, so, you know, what do you think about, like, abortion? She went, I totally agree with it. I said, but you're a Catholic? And she went, no, I'm a proper Catholic. Right. I said, okay, what do you think about, like, contraception? She went, absolutely, I have contraception. So I was like, yeah, what do you think about armed struggle? And she said, if necessary. Right. Now, what I'm trying to say about that is that I think that it did motivate a lot of people, that approach did motivate a lot of people. The problem was, it didn't come about because they decided to do it, the church. Similarly, they didn't decide to do the King James Bible because they thought it was a good idea. Like, they did it because they were in a situation where they were under pressure in those areas in Latin America or in Britain in the 16th century. They had to react.
I'm going to come to you.
It comes from the people, it doesn't come from the church.
Did you have a comment back on that?
Well, I'm
just going to go to the audience first. I'm just checking with you. Do you mind just saying who you are again?
My name's Matthew. Right. When I was young, sorry, this might sound like a slight digression, but I will get back to the point. When I was young, I used to go to a youth club that was very church-based, and I really, really enjoyed it. But what stopped me going was at the end of the day, we'd always do this sort of little collective prayer, and there was a statement we all read, and it said words to the effect, like, you know, I wholeheartedly believe the book of the Lord is sort of necessary for me to be a Christian. I've forgotten what it's called. I decided when I was I guess I must have been about 12 or 13, I had to stop going to this thing, because although all my mates went, I felt I was being disingenuous by reading this statement at the end with everybody. And to begin with, I was just sort of quiet. And I was sort of wondering, so for me, that very statement sort of drove me away from what I found was quite a fun community event as a kid. I suppose I was wondering if that is something or other that you think goes on in this modern day on a regular basis, sort of bringing the book into the modern day arena.
Tim? I'm tempted to play your bit now and share it, in the sense that what I would really like to talk about is the Bible and not the church. Yeah. And we're spending a heck of a lot of time just doing what, you know, the 21st century has done incredibly well so far, and that is institutional bashing, because we certainly need to take that seriously. You know, there's a camp in the middle of Bristol at the moment which is actually saying some really important stuff. I don't have any problem with that at all, and I'm very keen that we are thinking clearly about that, because we need some answers and they need to be more creative.
Would you have a problem with the meek shall inherit the earth now?
But my question about tonight is the Bible a dangerous book? And I kicked off by saying I think it is, because it actually is able to undermine and subvert the abuse of power. And it seems to me that it isn't, you know, a lot of the, say, the Gospels in particular, are really not, they're really not the kind of, you've got to stand here and do that and think the other. They are much more, here's a story. Now get inside it and move around. You know, most people know the story of, say, the Good Samaritan. And the idea of neighbour, you know, became a bit of an argument. What it really is about is not love your neighbour as yourself. You know, have a go at loving yourself first, and if there's anything left, then try and love your neighbour as much. It is actually much simpler than that. My neighbour is like me. And that's wisdom we need to know about. And that's the kind of stuff that comes out of these stories.
Can I come? I tell you what, I'm just going to give you just a really short comeback, yeah, and then I'll go to someone else.
I suppose, do you think it's a dangerous book, to sort of clarify my question, do you think it's a dangerous book in relation to Christians and getting people into the faith who these days taught about science? I suppose that's my sort of direct question. But
I haven't quite got it. Can you do that again?
So, we're very much taught to question lots of things in our schooling. Yeah. Do you think it sort of drives people who are taught that out of the church in this modern day and age, and therefore it's a dangerous book for Christianity having a set text?
Right. Is it suppress questioning? Is that what you're saying? Does the Bible suppress questioning?
Yeah. Does it push away people who are taught to avoid things that are be critical?
Okay. I'd come back quickly on that and say that. I have to be honest, the thing that really gives me energy for this whole thing is actually a person, not a book.
Yes, right.
I'm not a person of the book. People often say, you know, Christians are people of the book. No.
Right.
We're people about people, and the person I'm talking about is, of course, Jesus, who didn't go around saying, stop thinking. He said, when people asked a straight question, he actually often gave them something to really take them right to the edge of their fear, rather than just swallow this and believe it, shut up.
Right.
He didn't do that.
No. Okay, got a good few hands up here. I'm going to start with you because I saw you first just now.
Can you talking about, like, move it away from an institution and talk about the Bible, but surely if you've got a King James Bible which is going out to every person and they're putting the church in rather than the people, then that turns religion into something that's institutionalised. It means that you don't use these ideas to work out how you live. Someone else does, and they impose them on you, which has then meant that we're still in the 21st century, and it's taken us absolutely hundreds of years to people to get equal rights based on the idea based in this book. So I don't understand how you can say that it's Do you know what I mean? Like, because now it's saying the church. If you read people and put church in, then you're saying these. The church decides what you do, not you decide what you do. The church does, which has meant that then going on this church can use it. No, it's not, and it's like it's dangerous because it's meant that people go against the church and they get murdered for it, and it's taken ages for us to decide what we get to do because it's always been this higher power. So actually, it's incredibly important that this Bible's institutionalised it, because it's meant that people haven't got their own decisions, that the church does, and it can be used to dictate how people live and how they decide that they want to run their own society, like, especially in terms of women and in terms of race.
I'll take a few more comments as well from the do you want to go next? Just behind you.
Can we just be a neighbour to this guy? We just need to find somewhere for one chap to sit. Is it all right? I think we just
chair down by ear.
Any spare chairs? I can't see at all. Thank you guys. Sorry for interrupting.
Do you mind saying who you are from?
My name's Durston. I'm not very good with words, so like, so because you were saying like you're a man of Jesus and not a man of the book, or you know, that you're focused on Jesus, but the book that apparently has the words of Jesus and all of this was written like, what, 400 years after he was around? And it wasn't written at the time, and so the stories were passed on, so we don't even know these words that are in there, they even said them, like, and all the stuff that's in there are these stories that are passed on by word, so we don't know, you know, so something can develop from being like this bloke who, there was a load of rain, so we had to get a load of these short-legged animals into his house, is then told as a story and turns into some bloke who gets a boat and fills all the animals in the world in one boat, like, you know. So, like, that's what I don't get, you know, because I was a Christian. And it's things like that when you know, it's not the word of Christ and the word of God, because it was written years after it all happens, like, you know, years and years, like.
Okay. And actually, just so that we don't end up with a cross-examination of Tim and his personal faith, if there were Christians in the audience as well who might have a thought on it, or people who are leaving a bit, you know, trust your hands up, you may want to cross sign or something.
The New Testament actually was written within, most of it was written easily within 100 years of Jesus.
Dude, that's still 100 years. Like.
Well, what I'm saying is, in terms of the actual books being consolidated as what they were, the traditions that fed into them would have been part of the oral traditions that were passed on, as all such stories and information was passed on at the time, and would have fed into things that had been written down and collated by those communities that eventually fed into the finished versions of the Gospels. And I think most biblical scholarship pretty much attests to something easily within that framework, if, you know, some of it much earlier, but certainly not outside. You get the Gnostic Gospels and stuff come about 400 years later, but you know, they're still not in the canon of scripture.
It's still a very long time, you know.
Not for the kind of thing that what
I was just going to say that it's not just the fact of when it was written afterwards, but also, I mean, we haven't just got this sort of like putting what they want in the King James Bible, but right from the beginning in the Bible, the Gospels that were chosen, I mean, there's plenty of other Gospels that were written which are hidden away in the depths of the Vatican because they didn't agree, because when the Bible first came out, it was Romans who wanted it, and there was a lot of early Christians who were against the Roman Empire. They were an occupying force and they didn't want it, and so the Romans wanted to stop it being anti-Roman, so a lot of Gospels were never included. And you know, so from right at the beginning, it has been it's been sort of modified to suit what the powers in authority wanted.
I'm going to take a couple more comments, and then we'll come back to the panel and just ask them to pick up on any themes that have really struck them from what's been said.
Just a couple of things. The first thing, which I'll come back to in a minute, I was brought up in a village not far from here, which had a place called Ranter's Green.
Oh, wow.
And, but I wanted to sort of pick up first on your point about the thing about the distinction between the Bible and the church. I mean, from my experience being brought up in this place, which was, which had very strong non-conformist tradition of Methodism, was that everywhere we went, we had the Bible stuffed down our throats. When we went to school, people in authority were teaching us the Bible. Then I was in the Cubs, and it was the Methodist Cubs, first Free Methodists. We had a Methodist minister, similar to Matt's experience, ramming it down our throats. But we're in the Scouts, the same story. And this particular Scout actually was sexually abusing some of the kids, right? So my experience of authority, people in power, people who actually had all the power in that community, who had access to all the resources, all the community centres, everything, was the church.
And so the danger in that instance, what you're saying that makes it danger in that instance, is that the Bible was the basis of their authority from which they were imposing their thoughts and opinions on other people.
Can I just make my second point?
Okay.
Going back to Ranters Green, there was a very, as I said, it was a very strong, this is the Forest of Dean, it was a very strong non-conformist tradition. People saw this in the 19th century. They saw that the Methodist ministers were in league with the coal owners, the mining area. The Methodists were in league with the coal owners. Right? They didn't want people striking, so they became primitive Methodists. And again, they started having ministers come going around being primitive Methodists, teaching this Bible. They rejected that as well, and they became ranters. Right? And this is in the 19th century. You can go through court records in the Forest of Dean, and there's a lot of people who get picked up for social crime.
Yeah.
People like poachers and stuff, writing on the court records, they're ranters. And the ranters rejected that Bible completely because they saw it was a fortress. It was simply a way of oppressing them.
I'm just going to go over to this gentleman over here, then I'm going to come back to you three and ask for to pick up on any things that have really stood out.
My name's Michael. I'm a Baptist minister. So my tradition is non-conformism. My tradition says that in this very city, my spiritual ancestors were murdered by the church. And actually, the belief, one of the things I love is the fact that you picked up on the meek will inherit the earth and now. And that's exactly how my tradition translates it. My tradition doesn't say that the Sermon on the Mount, and in particular the Beatitudes, are something for the future, but are something for today. And actually, you know, it is true that that some of the Bible stories were written down much later, but within the lifetime of most of the people. So many of the Gospels were written by people who lived and spent time with Jesus. And I think the critical thing is that throughout the history of the Bible, the words of Jesus himself have been suppressed by those who would want those words not to get out. And actually, it's the words of Jesus that are the real words that turn that Bible from just a book into something really amazing and really powerful. And it's the words of Jesus that have got suppressed. And those very words of the meek shall inherit the earth now that have been suppressed, that actually are the words that we need to recover, we need to rediscover, and we need to find ways of bringing back into our society. Simply the question of, should we all love each other? Let's go back to Jesus. What did he say? They asked him what the greatest commandment was. He said, love God and love your neighbour as you love yourself. And I think if we started reading those words of Jesus with much, much, much more authority than we've done in history, then actually that book would be the most dangerous book in history.
Okay, we're going to go to each of the panellists now.
Yeah.
Lots of questions come up.
Depends how much time you've got.
What have we got?
Go on, it's fine.
Yeah, okay, let's do one more and then we'll come to you.
My name's Graham. I'm possibly not the only Buddhist here, but I'm a Buddhist. I'm very interested in the question. Well, I'm listening to all three and I can see an agreement, actually, that the book, the Bible, is actually a dangerous thing. For both ways, for good and for bad. We can go, you know, from Jamaica. Jamaica's got more churches per capita than anywhere on the planet. So, and I see the compromise that the book has given. Has given rise to amazing things and amazing things. And I think by the title itself is actually a passing of the buck, because it's we, humans, that actually compromise the book and the words. Yeah. Yeah. Right? So we can go on to Cows Come Home about this, that and the other, St. James or whatever. But at the end of the day, humans have interpreted this book we've used it to compromise its integrity and ourselves. We've done it constantly, constantly. We probably, maybe in my lifetime, won't even stop. But so that's the question I'm putting on, that maybe we should talk about just how the book has lost its integrity and how we can bring the integrity back to this book. The good things, like the gentleman just pointed out, like that, there's some very, very important words in that book. And I say that as a Buddhist.
Okay, so let's start with you, Roger, and then we'll go to you, Tim, and then come back to you, Steve.
Yeah, well, I think yeah, you bring up an important point. I mean, I would definitely agree on that perspective. Is I definitely disagree with this idea that we the people have all interpreted this book, and you know, we're all, you know, have compromised it. Well, no, actually, it's not like that most of the time. Actually, there are institutions who are deciding what the doctrine is that's being taught. There are institutions that are living off the backs of people, and that's what all religious institutions have done historically. They have to have a material basis, so they have to take money, they have to take wealth or goods off people in order to survive. So, you know, it's not straightforward. It's not just we, as though we're all equal and, you know, something. We're not equal. We're definitely separated by power relations. We're definitely separated by access to resources and the ability to read and write, even now. Like, you know, and we're also not in the point, you know, these institutions are there to mediate the ideas. Now, what I would say about that, you know, not get me wrong, I don't actually believe in the word atheist, because I don't think I'm without theism. I don't think it's a silly word, but I'm definitely an atheist. But what I would say is, what really interests me about religion is the fact that there's so much human experience within it, right, that has been mediated back to us. So, for example, you know, I can stand on a football terrace and sing a song, you know, with people at football tennis. There ain't many people mediating me there. There's nobody telling me what to sing, really. I sing along with everybody else. But in a church, I'm doing exactly the same thing, getting the same human experience, and it's wonderful. Singing in lots of people is brilliant. In a church, I'm getting it, but I'm singing their hymns, right, under their guidance, right. Now, I recognise that the mate over there is a Baptist, like, you know, how nonconformism threatened that. You know, it threatened it, because it started to say, you know, this is all tat. This is all tat, all this stuff. It's just people taking from us, right, and making pay money for it as well, you know, to feel guilty or something. You know, but it's all tat. Let's level it. Religious levelling is very important, right, because I think it starts to... And you start to get critical theory then. You get critical responses. People start to interpret it differently. I want to see a diversity. I want to see that... I actually want to see all those religious hierarchies and institutions collapse. And eventually Christianity will disappear into human community as part of all of our experiences as a world, and not just Christianity. It will dissolve into that. That's what.
How much of what we do is just of the individual? I mean, even on a football terrace. I mean, I more rugby. You know, you sing songs that are received. Someone gets up and becomes the song leader and leads the crowd in
the
singing.
No one's ever left me.
And it's under the banner of a particular team, of a particular structure with a label to it that you become a member of by participating.
Yes. Well, just quickly, if you've stood in a football crowd, you'll know, right? It's not just somebody leading everybody. What you get is lots of songs and lots of people shouting stuff out, trying to lead songs and creating new stuff. It's part of a creation. It's not mediated. It's not mediated by somebody standing there. I am the person who gives you the word, who gives you the song from this text. It will never work. It's much better.
But I'm going to labour the point. I'm forever blowing bubbles.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a received song.
It's
you sing
correct
that song.
Answer.
But you say, I know. But you sing that song because that's the club song.
Yeah, but we sing a lot of other things as well, which you probably don't want me to sing now.
Probably not.
Not
on tape. Anyway. Okay, Tim.
yeah, I mean, there's just so much here, but one of the things which is going round and round and round is, I sometimes summarise it as follows. Lots of us are spoken to with an insight and a wisdom that we suddenly find changes our perception. And you might call that a vision, because you see things differently. It's an awakening. And I think that this is a very exciting time to be alive now, because lots of people know that we need an awakening, and there are evidences of that. Call that a vision. If you look at the career of these things, it can be like this. You know, vision leads to mission. Mission leads to institution. Institution leads to monument. Monument becomes oppressive. And if you look at many of the institutions that we have, whether it's the army, the police, a government, the church, it's the same you know, we have an argument to have a police force in this country. And I was very interested at the way the police operation happened in our own city here during one of the demonstrations about cuts and university fees and all that stuff. I was out on Park Street being able to talk to some of the police. And they're good guys, you know, but there were three times as many there than there needed to be. And it was an own goal. So, you know, an institution needs checking. And that goes for churches as well as governments.
But if the meek is going to inherit the earth, how are we going to do that with the police then?
Let me just put the institution on one side, because what I'm interested in is not just spending a whole evening bashing institutions, yes, of course. But what really interests me is what's our take on the needs of the world at this moment? And I'll give you an example. We can what some people call text sling forever. But at the risk of doing that, to illustrate how institution, church, for example, has actually put a slightly different spin on some very important words in the Gospels. Jesus said, whoever would save their own life will lose it. One of the Gospels says, whoever would save their own life will lose it. Whoever will lose their own life for my sake and the gospel will save it. Get the difference? I think we live in a time when we have such a rampant individualism. Pause. I think we're actually burning up the planet for those sorts of reasons. And the idea that I must go for me to look after myself, whoever would save their own life, will certainly not only lose it, but lose other people's too. And it's about recognizing that we have one source, we are needing to live as one people, and loving neighbour as self, not as somebody else who needs a bit more love. Neighbour is part of me. And Desmond Tutu has said this thousands of times, you know, you lot in Europe talk about I think, therefore I am. That's the basis of much of our culture in Europe. He says, we know a different thing. I am because we are. And there are various versions of that piece of wisdom. And that's some of the stuff that actually is from the Gospels.
It's Ubuntu, yeah?
Ubuntu.
Steve.
Thank you very much. I'd just like to take on my Baptist comrade over there. Greetings. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, that book was written over 2,000 years ago, give or take a few decades, you know. We've moved on a lot from there, you know. There's no more stonings, etc., etc. And let's be fair, it didn't do Jesus a lot of help, did he? He ended up getting nailed up. You know, nothing has changed. You've had 2,000 years with the book, and we're still in the same mess, the same old, same old. Some people read the Bible, and are moving away from the church now to the Bible, for good effect. Some people, a more majority, I believe, don't. I think most people don't even understand it. As we've all discovered this afternoon, this evening, whatever, it's been mistranslated, there's been bits taken out of it and such like. What I'm arguing for is a different consensus, something else, you know, where we move away from this, what I believe is a dated, out-of-date book of stories. And I just want to wrap up, you asked about it being, dangerous. I'd just like to wrap up with a quote, if that's all right, from D.H. Lawrence, and this comes from page 174 of the Brad book. I'll be very quick. D.H. Lawrence. Like every nonconformist child, I had the Bible poured into my helpless consciousness till there came also a saturation point. Long before I could think or vaguely understand, this Bible language became soaked in. They became an influence which affected all the process of emotion and thought. That is brainwashing. That is dangerous. And that is basically how the Bible was used for eons and decades. And that is part of the reason why we're still in this predicament we are now.
Now, we spoke earlier on about why we're still discussing it. And just on what you kind of picking up on what you said there. And most read the Bible for good, but you said many more. Well, you said more read it for ill.
I believe so.
Which is, we'd have to kind of dig into that one a bit more to shore it up. But isn't the fact that it is still contested, doesn't that say that we still need to be having these debates? And actually we need to keep the debate alive because it is such an influential book. And that actually, going back to Graham's point, who's going to own the legacy of what this book is actually about? Who's going to control,
The next version.
Well, who's going to control? Who's going to be at the vanguard of interpretation? Is it going to be the group of people that you're concerned about, the institutions who would use it for ill and use it to oppress and stifle thought and so forth, the arguments you're making? Or will it be, I suppose, the people like Cornel West, James Cone, who would say, actually, this is the point, this is the book of the prophetic, the radical, the criticism of institutions, the book that says we should be fighting against poverty. Doesn't that say we should be having these debates going on?
Well, the Bible's there. As I said, it hasn't done anything. I mean, at the end of the day, if anything, we should debate in why our elderly are still being treated appallingly in home cares and in hospitals, because apparently we as a nation can't afford it. But we're still bailing out the bankers. You know, we live in a society that is so skewed. I pick up on your point about individualism, you know, getting back to Thatcher and such like, you know. I mean, we are in such a predicament in society at the moment, and the Bible's been read and reread. You get the old evangelical going around waving their collective arms about, but it hasn't changed one solitary thing. I can't see any benefit that's come out of it whatsoever. We're still living in an appalling situation in society that's going to necessitate massive social change. Rather than sitting here debating the Bible, I think you're right. I think we should be debating how as a city we can feed ourselves, how we should get renewable energy, how we should regard ourselves on our planet, and how we should regard ourselves in vis-a-vis other human beings. The Bible's an old book. It's gone.
Okay. So we'll go over here first. I'm going to take just 5 points in.
Well, I've been very attentive to everything which has been said. I have been very attentive to the voices that I heard. I have been very attentive to the faces that are in front of me. And as a result, I'm finding that there are two angry gentlemen and a very calm, collective. So if it is a result, I would in fact go for the Bible to see how I can keep calm and collected and quiet and not go bopping. That's my conclusion.
I think there was probably a few angry slaves about.
I just want to say, I read the Bible. I don't read the King James Version, but I read the Bible. And I know lots of Christians who are motivated by the words of Jesus, who are doing some really good social action projects all over the world, in the UK, in Bristol. And I don't think saying that we can just disregard the Bible is... You know, there are so many good things that are happening. Yes, there have been some really bad things that have been done, but I think there are so many positive things happening. That, you know, that we kind of singing from the same hymn sheet in a way, that we know what needs to be done. And there are some Christians who are doing some great stuff around social justice and fighting poverty, inspired by the Bible.
I saw your hand up ages ago, so I'm going to come to you.
Okay, I just wanted to say that actually it says that the fruits of the Spirit, which is the Holy Spirit, are love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, and self-control. Now, I don't know any other text that teaches young children, who are the next generation, such great wholesome values, because actually, in a relationship with God, that's a life that you don't have to pay for a counsellor. God is there all the time, giving you those things that you need to do to be whole, and those fruits.
Can I just stay over here with this gentleman with the t-shirt?
Yeah, the problem is, we can look at, say, the actual teachings of Jesus, ignore the idea of the like interpretation of the Bible or whatever, and then we've got to look at ultimately comes a point where a lot of those beliefs have what's the impact on the individual themselves. I think the idea of, say, for example, forgiving everyone unquestioningly, That's actually dangerous. That leaves you in a situation where you can be exploited by other people. Also, from the point of view of... sorry, I'll leave you there.
That's okay. we'll just take a couple of people who haven't spoken. You haven't spoken and you haven't spoken. So I'm just going to take these two last points and then come back to the panel, if that's okay. I'll tell you what, I'll start here because it'll be easier for you. All right, go down there. This gentleman down here at the end of the banister with the flat t-shirt.
There's been very strong events through history that have linked in
what you could call the eschatological, the sense of there is going to be a millennium ending and a coming together of everyone in a almost a utopian vision, linked in with very strong social and political action. You only have to take two figures. One, Thomas Munzer from the Peasants' Revolt, and the other, Win Stanley, the digger. Now, both were eschatological. They thought that the coming of the coming of the utopian future was on the doorstep. But at the same time, they were against the princes, against the kings. Munzer, in his big debate with Luther, was very clear about Luther. Okay, the start of the Reformation, getting rid of a lot of the nonsense of the ritual, was also very much on the side of the princes, those princes who represented the power over the common people. And just one thing about Jesus, of course, he hung out with zealots. He hung out with a load of people. He hung out with whores, and St. Paul called the people, referred to the people that Jesus hung out with as the shit of the earth. And you can read that in the Bible. So Jesus was not a revolutionary, give unto Caesar, but he was a pragmatic person.
Okay. All right. Just one more comment, and we'll come back to the panel for just
30
second comebacks.
Yeah, it's just like a quick point. Since I noticed, like tonight, and like listening to other debates of this sort, is that it seems to me that apologists for Christianity and the oppression that it has been responsible for the last 2,000 years always seem to, when they're met with like a point at their expense, say, oh, but Christianity, or the Bible, the Church. You know, you can debate about, you know, how they interlink, whatever. Say, oh no, when it's responsible for something bad, it's like, yeah, it's been misinterpreted or it's been used by people for their own ends. When it's something which they're advancing as a good thing, it's like, yeah, this is the Bible, this is Christianity. So basically willing to always take the credit, not accept any of the responsibility, to be honest. And, you know, I mean, like, just the point that someone else made that a lot of Christians do good things. Well, yeah, I mean, it's totally irrelevant point to make, to be honest. I'm sure, like, if you lived in Nazi Germany and you were a Nazi, the Nazis did great things as well. It's a completely irrelevant point to make because lots of people do good things, full stop. Doesn't matter where, you know, it's not a particular plus in favour of Christianity that some people do some nice things in its name. Because there are plenty of other things on the other side of the coin have been done as well.
I'm going to come back, and we have to pick it up. I'm going to come back to the panelists' final comments. I'll go to you first, Steve, this time.
I'm just like to pick up two things. My colleague there, who said about being calm and such like. So, I mean, that part of the problem with the Bible as well is common eternal life, and you know, you'll get it in the end. You know, whilst we're expected to calmly accept the status quo with the state and such like, you know, it's past the point now. I believe so, but I do get what you're saying. What the friend there says about the nice things in the Bible, you're very right. It does say some beautiful things in the Bible, but does it not also say spare the rod and spoil the child? That's child abuse. There's a lot of nasty things it says in the Bible as well. You know, in the whole book in the context, that's the King James Bible, you might not have read it. The whole Bible in its entirety isn't just about being nice. There's some really quite vicious stories in there. You know, at the end of the day, what I believe is we need something in the base.
Tim?
Very simple. If you give me a choice between what kind of human person I want to actually put at the centre, you know, where am I going to put my shirt in the end? And I think all the stuff about God is extremely difficult. The stuff about the Church, we've given it a fair old bashing. But in the end, we all have to make a decision about what does it really mean to be human. So JC gets my vote on that.
Roger.
Yeah, well, I think this, he's made a really good point about forgiveness, you know, about this problem, you know, which is this Steve mentioned it as well, which is that, you know, I look at the Bible, and when I read it, when I was younger, I was forced to read part of it, you know, school and stuff like that. When I read it, I kind of, you know, I picked up on strategies within it. Certain stories have been emphasised, and one of the strategies, for example, is, you know, displacement of pleasure and desire, displacement into the future when you're dead, you know, to get people to work and suffer and discipline themselves to do stuff, and to put up with it, to basically put up with it. And that's a big problem for me, and that's why I'm angry, and that's why he's angry, because we don't actually believe in that. I mean, I would say, and I'd be cruel, I mean, honestly, I'm not a Christian, but I think that if you accept those conditions, you accept them, i.e. you might not agree with them, and your Bible might say they're wrong, but if you accept them, right, then that's not very Christian.
Okay. Thanks very much, guys. I really appreciate it. I kept my mouth shut the whole time.
I know.
I must share. Yeah. I think everyone should read Letter from Birmingham Jail, Martin Luther King, when he got criticised by church leaders for protesting on the streets. And he said, I've walked down your streets and I've seen your seminaries. And I thought, who worships there? Who is their God? And that's one Christian challenging others about the role of the church in Christianity and the displacement of justice into the future. Just, Lots of things in there. But hopefully it's thrown up lots of questions. I think this is the type of thing that makes Bristol exciting, actually. And that these things, not that it can't go on in other places, but there's a fertile ground.
We're special,
we're special. we are. But it's great to be able to do this. So thanks very much, Yari, for putting this on this evening, and to the host for having us. And I don't know how long you're allowed to hang around and have a chat, but thanks for your participation.